So thanks for, everyone very much for coming, and we've got a small audience, so except makes it more conducive to questions. Please just interrupt at any time if you have a question. So this is part of a larger research program that I've been working on now for a number of years, primarily with Andrew Doherty, who's who's not one of the people involved in this particular piece that we're going to look at today, though. So quantum computational phases of matter, I'll start off by saying a bit about what I mean by that. And then I'm going to focus on a specific result I've done recently with Gavin Brennan, Akimasa Miyake, and Joe Renes on measurement-based quantum computing in the Haldane phase. And I'll explain to everyone what those are, what those terms mean as well. So please interrupt if I'm saying something that's unclear. It's meant to be very pedagogical. Okay, so I'm going to start off with a very broad introduction of what is measurement-based quantum computing, now around for almost a decade, but still, I think, a very striking and different way of looking at quantum computing from the normal perspective. Rather than thinking of quantum gates as proceeding with unitary transformations, we're thinking of our gates proceeding through measurements. So instead of the Schrödinger equation, I guess we have wave function collapse as the fundamental dynamics that's driving the computation. And there's a bunch of experimental reasons to think in various systems why this might be easier to do these strong incoherent measurements than to try to do these idealized unitary evolutions. But I'm not going to be talking about experimental realizations of this. I'm going to be thinking of this very much from a theorist perspective. And asking questions about what it means to do measurement-based quantum computing and what are the properties of a state you need. So this measurement-based quantum computing proceeds when you're given a resource in the form of a particular entangled state. And one such resource, a canonical resource, is the cluster state, which originates with Rausendorf and Briegel almost a decade ago. And it's our canonical example of measurement-based quantum computing. I like to think of this thing as like a one of these breadboards for electronics, which has the potential for you to wire up any circuit you want on it. Similarly, a cluster state it has no program on it. It's completely arbitrary at the beginning, and you choose the computation you want to do through your choice of measurements that you subject it to. So it's a highly specific entangled state of many systems on say, a lattice. It could be 1, 2, 3 dimensional, or we can even think of higher dimensional lattices. And I think what's great from a theorist perspective is that having this resource state lets us phrase a lot of questions about computation in terms of questions about the state. And in particular, we can try to say, what makes the cluster state work? What are its properties in terms of correlations or type of entanglement? And what properties of another resource state are required if we want to use it for measurement-based quantum computation? Okay? So it's very much a physicist perspective on doing quantum computation and thinking of the resources. Okay, so where do we get these resource states? Well, as originally proposed by Rausendorf and Briegel, these were constructed out of a bunch of unitary gates on unentangled qubits. But a perspective that came out of Rausendorf's later work was that we could also view this as the ground state of some coupled many-body system. The advantage of that perspective is you can think of creating this thing not by having to build a quantum computer that can do these unitary gates between a whole bunch of qubits, but thinking of just having some system, maybe artificial, maybe even natural, where we just have to cool it. We have an incoherent dissipative process, cool it down to its ground state, we have our resource. They're ready to be measured. And so you might think of this type of thing going on in some sort of optical lattice, and I've just stolen the prettiest picture I found immediately on Google. The type of Hamiltonian you might want to get the cluster state is something with five-body terms in it. And I'm not going to go into the details of that at all, but you might imagine artificially constructing a Hamiltonian, or even more interestingly, look for natural systems that have such a ground state. Now, if you're taking this perspective, rather than constructing this state with unitary gates and thinking about errors and error corrections and so on, a more natural error model you might have, if you're thinking of it from a many-body perspective, is, well, what if I don't exactly have the idealized Hamiltonian I'm looking for? What if I have this Hamiltonian is basically describing things, but I have a bunch of other terms, maybe local terms, that are going to mess things up? And what kind of effect will they have on my state? So the basic question you would ask if you are thinking of things from a many-body perspective is, are the properties of the state I want robust, or are they fragile against these types of perturbations, or maybe against having some finite temperature rather than being exactly in the ground state? And so this is a question, when you phrase it that way, which is more naturally asked in terms of phases. Now, when we think of a superconductor, we have very idealized models, such as the BCS Hamiltonian, which describes superconductivity. And if you're in a low enough temperature with a system that's described by that Hamiltonian, of course, it will behave as a superconductor. But we can have all sorts of perturbations. That Hamiltonian is just an idealization, and there's many systems out there which aren't exactly described by that, have a bunch of other terms that are having some effect, but really, once we get into this phase, it behaves as if you have this idealized state in some way. And so the basic question I'm trying to ask is there a similar sort of thing for quantum computational resource states? That we can have entire phases where no matter what the Hamiltonian is, as long as we're somewhat close or connected to this idealized Hamiltonian, that any ground state within that phase will serve as a resource. And at this point, you might be kind to me and just say, okay, yeah, naturally, okay, that's the type of thing we should be looking for. So let me put forward an argument why you might think that's crazy. Or are you going to do that, Rob?
When you say phase, you mean a region of the parameter space of your Hamiltonian?
Yes. Or as you can think of as a function of temperature as well. So, but for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to be thinking more in terms of parameters.
Are you implying a phase transition in the technical sense, or are you using phase more loosely?
So I guess what you would hope for is when you're cooling down your system, or when you're adjusting the parameters in your artificial Hamiltonian, that you go through some phase transition, and then you end up in this new phase, and you don't really care where you end up. The idea here is we're going to want to be sort of far from the phase transitions. We're going to want to be in the middle of the phase, where we say we're very well described by our idealized model there. Okay. All right, so let me put forward the argument to say that this is actually quite a crazy idea. When you have a superconductor, well, we talk about a superconducting phase and say it's basically like a BCS Hamiltonian. But one thing we never ask is, what is electron number 3486 doing? We don't care about individual electrons or any specific microscopic quantity in that system. We're just interested in some overall bulk behavior, some macroscopic behavior. In measurement-based quantum computing, it's very, very different. We care quite precisely what is qubit number 3486 doing, and what is the outcome of the specific measurement I do on that qubit. I'm going to have to base my next measurement on the outcome of that previous one. So we're very much interested in the microscopic details, and so it's not at all obvious that this question even makes sense. So purpose of my talk, the main thing I want to get across is that actually this idea does make sense, and we have a method for I guess making sense of this question, and it's again a method that comes from condensed matter theory. We're going to be looking for suitable order parameters, as in correlation functions in our lattice and the behavior of them, that are associated with my ability to do gates in measurement-based quantum computing. And that I'm going to be able to say, if my order parameters are characterizing a specific phase, if they take high, long-range values as correlation functions, then I'm going to be able to do measurement-based quantum computing, regardless of what is the exact form of the Hamiltonian or of the state that I have.
The main Hamiltonian.
So maybe even a preemptive question. So here I'm talking very much in abstract. We're going to add some local terms. Of course, we're going to have to look at some specific models as to what the perturbation would mean if we're actually going to say anything definite. But by looking at some specific models, we're going to have some evidence that really this idea holds, sort of regardless of the type of thing that you might have.
Okay, but my question is that, so this computation should work for complex combination of ground states of those Hamiltonians, or are you just looking to each?
Oh, okay, good question. So if I took just a mixture of one ground state and another, and they both had sort of the same value of these order parameters, that's telling me how I can do my gate. Even though they might be different states, yes, I would say that taking a convex combination of them would also be a reasonable state.
Is it clear? I mean, I can't see that, but is it clear?
Well, so let me show you how I define these order parameters and so on, and maybe we can come back to that at the end. No, it should be obvious at this stage. So what I'm going to do is start off with the basic idea phrased in terms of a Torrey Hamiltonian for which the cluster state is the ground state. So just quickly, what's the idea of doing measurement-based quantum computing with a cluster state? Well, one perspective on it is that you're using this cluster state to prepare resources for gate teleportation. Okay. So I might say, within my lattice, I just want to do the simple operation, which is move a qubit from here over to there. And I'm going to do that by trying to prepare a maximally entangled state between these two qubits that I can then teleport my information across. Well, how could I do that? In the cluster state model, you can go in and measure a bunch of qubits on either side of some connected path between the two in the Z basis. That sort of removes those qubits from the cluster. And in the intermediate region, you measure in the X basis. And what you're left with at the end of this measurement is a maximally entangled state between here and here. And the specific maximally entangled state will depend on those measurement outcomes, which of the four Bell states you get. But if you know the measurement outcomes, you know which Bell state you have, and you can do teleportation. So I'm not going to go any more into the details of specifically how cluster state quantum computing works. Just take away this central idea that through measurements, I can prepare resource states such as entangled states over long distances in my cluster state. That lets me do the identity gate. And then I'd want to make more complicated entangled states for doing more complicated gates. Okay, so that's probably what I just said over on the side. We know the state we get up to some sort of unitary correction on one of the qubits. We can get different gates through different choices of measurements. And by looking at the resulting state that we get here, we can say something about how that resource before I measured it was useful for doing that gate. And that's what I'm going to try to describe mathematically on the next slide, is to relate a quantum gate in measurement-based quantum computing to a correlation function on the state before I do any measurements. So this rho naught is going to be my state before measurements. Rho, I put on a subscript PM to mean the post-measurement state. So what I'm going to do is measure this resource state with some choice of measurements. I'm going to get a specific set of measurement outcomes which corresponds to a specific projector on a whole bunch of intermediate qubits. That projector is this PJ. J is just labeling the measurement outcomes. And based on what the value of J is, I'm going to do a unitary correction, which is just going to act on one of the systems. Okay, so that's a very abstract way of describing just I've taken a state, I've measured it, and done some unitary based on those measurement outcomes. And then I sum over all possible measurement outcomes because I want this to work deterministically. Okay, so then I can look at, say, correlations between two observables, between the two qubits in my post-measurement state, in terms of expectation values on the pre-measurement state, and then here's our projectors and our unitaries. So this first term is just an identity, and then I'm redefining, as I said, I'm only going to do a unitary correction on the second system, which I'm calling B, so I'll just define this Bj as this unitary correction on that B observable. Okay. And if you look at the gates in cluster state quantum computing, they have this sort of magical relation that I can relate the measurements and the resulting correction that I do, the unitary correction, in a particular way such that I can express the final post-measurement correlation between these two qubits after I've done all the measurements in terms of some expectation value of an operator on the pre-measurement state, where now this operator S spans all of the qubits that I measured in order to produce this final state. Okay. The central idea here is that I can talk about how good the post-measurement state is in terms of looking at observables like XX or ZZ in terms of the expectation value of some operator on the pre-measurement state where that operator actually spans all the qubits that I'm going to measure. So these types of correlations in the pre-measurement state tell me what types of correlations I'll get after measurement. Let me give you, yep.
I don't quite follow. If you substitute your ABJ, PJ into that expression, you're still going to have a PJ projector onto J left over.
So you notice how now I've swapped that PJ around. It's now on the other side. So using the properties of the trace, this PJ is coming over here and connects. It's a projector, so it squares to the identity. And then the sum, now it's the only thing that depends on J. So the sum over J of that projector is just a resolution of the identity. And so it drops out.
When you say the projector squares to the identity.
No, sorry, the projector squares to itself.
Right.
And the sum over all projectors is the identity.
Okay, good.
Okay, so let me just show you how that works in a specific example. Take the 1D cluster state, where all we're going to try to do is prepare a maximally entangled state between Alice's qubit and Bob's qubit. And I've color-coded things because it will have this sort of nice bipartite bicolorable expression. So I measure X on all the intermediate qubits, and I measure Z on the outside qubits to cut it off from the rest of the chain. This is what I know from measurement-based quantum computing will give me a maximally entangled state. If I just go through the formula I did on the previous screen in terms of this particular measurement sequence, it tells me that after I do the measurements, the correlation between X here and X here, that's XX on the post-measurement state, is just given by the expectation value of this string of operators on the pre-measurement state. Similarly for ZZ, that correlation on the post-measurement state in terms of a string of operators on the pre-measurement state. Okay. So the set of all of these operators, pairs of operators, completely specifies my post-measurement state. It tells me basically what's the fidelity I can do the identity gate as a teleportation between those two sites. I can write that entirely in terms of string-like correlation functions on the pre-measurement state. That means whatever the state is, cluster state or not, if I have large expectation values for these operators, it means I can pretend it's the cluster state, do the same measurement sequence, and I'll get something that's very close to the identity gate. And in 2D, you can make more complicated things which describe your ability to do one qubit gates over long ranges. And also, you can have more complicated ones which describe interaction gates, such as C0s and C5s and things like that. Okay. For every gate you have in measurement-based quantum computing, there's a correlation function on the pre-measurement state that describes how well that gate will work. Okay. So this allowed us to do a result. This is just a sort of a side note to the point I'm going to get into. If I take a simple model, which is this idealized cluster state Hamiltonian, which is negative the sum over the cluster state stabilizers, it has as its ground state the cluster state. If I had exactly that Hamiltonian, I just have to cool the system down to the ground state, and I get a cluster state. But I put on some perturbation. I put some local transverse field on there, so that B is meant to signify like a magnetic field. In this type of model, you can look at those correlation functions that describe your gates and measurement-based quantum computing as functions of B. And you find that these things are long-ranged in a whole phase that's defined by B less than 1, or the magnitude of B less than 1. Now, what does that mean specifically? The fidelity of your gate will be less than the cluster state. It'll be some function of B. But it will behave in a way that doesn't depend on the range, that I can teleport over arbitrarily long distances with fairly high fidelity anywhere using any state within this phase, even though it's no longer the cluster state. Okay? So this result was known numerically for a number of years in the 1D model. So Petrus and Plenio looked at this here. The relevant parameter that they plotted is this entanglement length, or localizable entanglement, as we now would call it. And it's diverging within this magnetic field going from plus 1 to minus 1 range. Okay? And then it drops off once you get out of that phase. It means now you have short-range localizable entanglement. But anywhere in this phase, you can teleport over infinite distances with some high fidelity. Andrew Doherty and I extended this result to two dimensions and did things analytically, showing that in two dimensions where you can actually do universal quantum computation, you have, in that phase, a gate set that has infinite range. So you can do C sines and arbitrary single qubit unitaries and so forth. Okay. Yes. It's pretty high. So specifically for the identity gate, it goes as like 1 minus b squared to the 1/8. So it's very, very high, and then close to the phase transition, it just drops right down. But if you're well in the middle region of that phase, it's very high. Okay. So this is exactly the type of thing we're looking for. It says that it's possible to have a whole universal phase rather than a universal resource state. Any state in that phase will serve as a resource for measurement-based quantum computing. And points out that measurement-based quantum computing in this thing is a new type of long-range order, that you can go out and test a system to see if it has that type of order, and it will tell you something about doing quantum computation. Yeah?
You look at this correlation function. Mm-hmm. Presumably, you take the cluster state, for instance, and it works nicely. There's going to be another anti-cluster state that's going to have the same correlation but with the opposite sign. That works too. And presumably, it's in the center of a phase that also works. But convex combinations of those two states won't work because the correlation function will be zero. So do we have multiple disjoint phases, or what?
Well, okay. If you're imagining a model that has those different regions, yes, they would be disjoint, because you're not going to be able to sort of continuously. Well, maybe you could come up with some strange model that continuously connects them.
Well, I think that you could imagine one where the correlation function was 1, and then a whole series where it's e to the I phi, and then it gets to minus 1. So there'd be a sort of a curved path, right, that distorts one into the other. But if you went convex combination, you'd go through a mixed state. It's like entangled states, right? Entangled states are unitary orbits, but if you mix them, two Bell states together, you get something separable.
Yeah, so it's true that if you want to use mixed states, then these things would actually have to take the same value of the correlation function, which is, or at least close to the same value. If you had, you know, a complete change of sign or something, so the trick here is that it's actually going to be a set of correlation functions which identifies any given gate, such as taking, say, you know, these pair, and you need more actually to completely specify the two-qubit state. Whether you can continuously transform that into something that has exactly the opposite properties is not entirely clear. But let me just say what we do know is that if you have two different states that actually have the same value of these correlation functions, even though they're different states, I can take convex combinations of them. I can treat that, I can just do measurements on that, pretending it's an ideal state, and I will get the gates working just fine.
Two states that are, there's a continuous family of states here, all of which work. But convex combinations of, you know, two of these states may not work. Do you consider these in the same phase? I'm trying to get a good handle on what you mean by phase here.
That's a good question, and I really don't know. I'm trying to think of another example where you can have the order parameter of a phase change continuously as you move, you know, through that phase to something that then takes a very different value without having gone through a phase transition.
Are you saying that for lots of points in Hamiltonian space in this phase, the order parameter will have the same value?
I mean, it's certainly very close. I mean, we might have to take that up. I'm trying to think of an example, but I'm not thinking of one on the spot. So as I said, that's quite a positive result, but this is very much a toy Hamiltonian and an idealized example. And so the question is, can we apply these types of results to some sort of realistic system? Or is this just a very unique property of the idealized cluster state? And so I'll show that actually there's a very nice realistic system where we can apply this. Before I get to that, I'm going to again talk a bit of an idealization, but one that is going to give us a handle on a realistic situation. So imagine one-dimensional spin chains, and we're going to be thinking of Hamiltonians that are rotationally invariant on this spin chain. Okay, so, I mean, these have long been of interest to condensed matter theorists. A very famous conjecture due to Haldane back in 83 is that the properties of the ground state and low energy excitations of these types of chains is very highly dependent on whether you have an integer or a half-odd integer spin. So in particular, the first type of chain that people looked at and were able to say something quantitative about was a spin half Heisenberg chain, and those things have very arbitrarily low energy spin wave excitations, and so there is no gap in that model. Okay, you have a ground state and you have excitations of arbitrarily small energy above that ground state. Without having an answer, Haldane conjectured that this was going to be very different for integer spins, and for example, a spin one chain would have a gap. A number of years later, Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb, and Sasaki, in a very seminal paper, they didn't prove the conjecture, but they gave an example that is consistent with that conjecture, a solution for a very specific rotationally invariant spin one chain, where they could show analytically that this does have a gap, and its low energy behavior is fundamentally different than the spin half chain. Okay, so they took this Hamiltonian, which has this particular choice of weights between this Heisenberg term and this S dot S squared term. These are the only two terms you can have in a spin one nearest neighbor rotationally invariant Hamiltonian. Then they just use some nice properties of angular momentum to show that each of these, the sum of these terms adds up to just the projector onto total angular momentum 2 of neighboring spins. Okay? So the ground state of this thing is going to be the state which neighboring pairs have no spin 2 component. And it turns out to be a unique state. And they constructed it through a very clever trick, which those of you in quantum information should now start to recognize. It's really taken off in our field. But this is the original source. This valence bond solid or projected entangled pair state picture for the ground state of this model. What they do is they want to describe spin 1s. But for the moment, instead of describing spin 1s on a site, they put two qubits on the next site, two qubits on the next site, and then attach neighboring sites, their qubits together in the singlet state, maximally entangled. Okay? And then they take the two qubits on that site and project it down to a spin 1 particle by just projecting out the singlet, i.e. the projection is onto the triplet, three-dimensional triplet space of that four-dimensional two-qubit site. Okay? And they do that everywhere. I don't want the remainder of my talk to get caught up with boundary conditions, which are really fairly irrelevant to what I'm going to say. So I'm going to pick a particular choice, which is to leave a dangling qubit at each end. And that will just be illustrative to my purposes. But take my word on it. I'm glad to discuss it later that the boundary conditions are not relevant to what we're going to be talking about from now on. We're interested in the bulk. Okay. So this defines a state. They were able to show, simply because it satisfies the fact that it has zero energy under this positive Hamiltonian, that it is the ground state. And then through a few more clever tricks, show that this system is gapped, and thus providing an instance to support the Haldane conjecture. OK, we're going to be very focused on this type of spin 1 problem, first in an idealization, and then a bit more physically real. So let's write out what is the wave function. Right.
Standard. Fixed boundary conditions. So what I have is a sum over a basis for each of my spin ones. So these b's each take 3 different values. I have a maximally entangled singlet state between my 2 end qubits. And I'm going to alter the second of the two spin half particles with a whole sequence of matrices that you multiply all those together and you get a single 2x2 matrix that will transform this maximally entangled state into something else. Okay. So it's maybe not obvious that this state does describe the ground state that we just saw before, but you can take my word on it, and I'm happy to discuss it later if you want.
Can you explain a little more what this is? Sign minus is the maximally entangled state of
what? Of these. So here's this single qubit here, A, and single qubit here, B, all the intermediate spin 1 systems. So I've done a weird ordering of how I've written it. I put all the intermediate spin 1 systems here. And the last two systems over there. Okay. So I've told you what those matrices are. So let me pick the basis for these spin ones. And I'll pick a particularly nice basis, which is the m value of jz is 0, is one of the states. For jy is 0, jz is 0. I'll just call these things x, y, and z. And check that those things are all mutually orthogonal. They form a basis. So really, I'm summing over each spin 1, taking x, y, or z. And the matrix over here for each of those is just the Pauli matrix, x, y, or z, where the z1 I've actually just chosen a sort of a real version. Okay. So that actually describes this this ground state. Okay. So let's just, for the moment, think about doing measurement-based quantum computing type things on this state. We have this particular state of this form, and you can already see that if I measure all of these intermediate qubits in this basis, then I'm suddenly cutting out the sum, and I'm giving very specific values to each of these matrices. Okay? Depending on the outcome I get, X or Z or Y or whatever, that means the matrix up here will be the Pauli X or Pauli Z or XZ. And at the end, once I've measured all of these intermediate ones, and I say, what is the resulting state on these two outer qubits? Well, I can just read it off from this top line. I just take the singlet and act on the B qubit with the product of all of the matrices that I got here. So I'll still have a maximally entangled state. It'll just be one of the Bell states. And that makes sense if you think about it from this perspective. The basis that you're measuring each of these spin ones in what I've just described, corresponds to, through this projection, doing a Bell state measurement of these two qubits. Now, we're in the triplet subspace, so we're doing one of the three Bell states that's not the singlet. But for each Bell state you measure, you're just doing teleportation or entanglement swapping, if you prefer to look at it that way. You're always going to get a Pauli correction, X, Y, or Z, because it's the singlet one that is the identity. Okay? So all I've talked about there is just a very fancy way to describe entanglement swapping or teleportation in this state. So at the end of the day, after all of these measurements, I've created a maximally entangled state up to some Pauli correction. And so I can use this state to do the identity gate if I want to just teleport a qubit from one end of the chain to the other. There's a way to do this without having to refer to the boundaries and actually do it in the bulk, but I'm not going to get into those details. Being a bit more clever, you can choose a slightly different basis where if you measure a qubit in this basis, here are the corresponding operators on or the corresponding matrices that you get. And so I can think of choosing a measure in this basis as a non-deterministic, probabilistic way of doing rotations about some axis. Okay? So if I get this outcome, I've done a rotation about the x-axis by an angle theta of my choosing that's defined by the basis. I'm going to get some Pauli correction. If I got this outcome, I'd have that rotation with a different Pauli correction. And if I got this outcome, I haven't done the rotation at all. And you'd say, well, I failed in doing that gate. But because you just get a Pauli correction, you can say, well, I'll try again. And because you only fail with probability 1/3, you can make this gate succeed with arbitrarily high probability by just trying enough time. So the rotation is probabilistic. But herald it. So if you get that first outcome, you just try again. Okay, so these are the basic ingredients that Gavin and Akimasa put together in a great paper from last year. Now, we just have one-dimensional chains here. So they think of a whole array of these one-dimensional chains this way, on which they can do any single qubit transformation. And to get a two-qubit gate, it's a bit of a hybrid scheme. They imagine actually some dynamics that's going to couple these chains together. So I think, you know, realist, in the long run, you know, you might imagine that there's some sort of two-dimensional generalization of this where everything is done through just local measurements. This is one step along that way. Okay? Okay, so they have a scheme for using this state, this AKLT state, as a resource for measurement-based quantum computing. It's very different from the cluster state, but because of these nice properties in terms of matrix product states and so on, you can still do things. Okay. So it has two nice properties. It's a simple system. And it has very nice algebraic properties which let you calculate things analytically and exactly. And it almost looks, you know, too good to be true. But it is true in a sense that it's a realistic type of model that accurately describes certain spin one chains. But what precisely do I mean by that when I say it's realistic? Well, I mean that a lot of systems are well described by a gapped spin one Hamiltonian on a chain. And you can say, well, here's the most general way I can write a rotationally invariant nearest neighbor spin one Hamiltonian on a chain. I have a single parameter defining the weight of these two couplings, and that AKLT state was a specific choice of that weight. That point is just one point within a whole phase where the system is gapped the system is gapped throughout that phase. And people loosely say that, well, if I have a spin one chain within that phase, it's like an AKLT state. But this is using, I guess, maybe the more loose language of condensed matter theory to say, well, I don't exactly have realistic systems described by the AKLT state. I have realistic systems described by some state within this Haldane phase. But, you know, it's never going to be so fortunate that these parameters are chosen to satisfy exactly that. So the question that we want to ask is this ability to do measurement-based quantum computing with the AKLT state actually a robust property of this whole phase, so that we can use these nice simple algebraic results for the exact AKLT state, but extend them to say that anything that is described by this sort of Hamiltonian, which is actually, because it's, I mean, you're using a symmetry to really restrict the form, you're saying I'm talking about an actual rotationally invariant Hamiltonian, there are systems that are very well described by this sort of for some theta that really are shown to be well described by being in this phase somewhere. So that's really the goal here, is to see if we can do that. Okay, so I see I'm going to have to speed through things a bit. So I might skip some steps. This is just a flashback to what we were doing before, this idea of looking for correlation functions. So can we seek out correlation functions for the AKLT state that were long range, that quantified our ability to do those gates, and then apply them to arbitrary states within that phase? Okay. So that's what we're going to do. It's very easy to figure out, following that procedure, exactly what these correlation functions look like. The post-measurement correlation for x and x between these n qubits looks like this string order parameter where I have an operator that is acting on all of these spins, where this intermediate operator is some exponent of the JZ operator. Remember, these are spin one particles, so I can't write it in terms of Pauli's. And similar for this ZZ correlation function. Okay, so these are the types of correlations, just like in a cluster state, we have these correlations that describe your ability to do the identity gate. These correlation functions describe your ability to do the identity gate in the AKLT state. And quite remarkably, it's been shown several years ago that throughout this Haldane phase, in fact, these correlation functions are long-ranged, are basically of infinite range, that they stay with the value 1 throughout that phase and then drop off very rapidly at the phase transition. Okay. So here's a paper that just sort of shows this in a localizable entanglement language, but this was known actually in the condensed matter community before this. Part of the reason that you get this nice exact result is if you look at what this operator is, this corresponds to flipping everything by 180 degrees about the x-axis, and this one about the z-axis. So having these things invariant has to do, again, with the rotational symmetry of this problem. But I won't get into the details. The key is that here we have some order parameters for the identity gate. And the new question we're going to ask is, can we apply the same idea to the rotation gates? And directly, well, before we even look for correlation functions that might be long range, we just check things numerically. These numerical results are done using getting an explicit matrix product state description for anywhere in the phase. So this is theta here describing AKLT point right here, and here's the Heisenberg point where there's no second term, and so on. These are all done by Joe Rennes. We look at what is this correlation function, or one of them, for describing the rotation gate about the x-axis by pi on 4, and we find that fidelity drops off fast. This is not the type of thing you expect an order parameter to do. We would expect the order parameter to stay very high right up into the phase transition, which is out here somewhere or out here somewhere, and then drop off. So this thing is dropping off in a bad way. This is suggesting that over long ranges, this rotation gate will not work unless you do something about it. Oh, yeah, sorry, a key point. So this is for a chain of, I think it was 50 spins, and it drops off with some rate after. You try to do one rotation and then continue down to the end of 50 spins. The reason you choose 50 is so that you're actually getting a matrix product state description from DMRG that's well described, as opposed to picking something that's just three. But if we made the chain longer and longer, this thing would drop off faster and faster. Okay, so that's bad.
So the horizontal axis here is theta. Sorry.
Yes.
And that's just the theta in the rotation gate.
This is the theta.
The theta in the phase.
In the phase. Yes. So this is in the rotation gate. It's a fixed pi on 4, which is sort of the worst one.
So it's not necessarily, you know, horrible that that drops with, this is the fidelity on the left, on the upper axis?
Yes.
So it's not necessarily horrible that that drops as your theta gets away from some point, if it maintains its long range value.
Yeah, so
it, also
it doesn't. As you go for longer and longer chains, this drops faster and faster. And then sort of in a thermodynamic limit, then you just have a point and it's zero on either side.
So this is one where you do it from one end of the chain to the other.
Okay. We have a way to fix it. So first, let's just think a bit intuitively on why these rotations are failing. So this is a different decomposition of the general Hamiltonian for anywhere in that phase. So instead of writing things in terms of a cos theta term and a sine theta term, we write things as sort of a perturbation around the AKLT state. And it turns out, again, by using the nice algebraic properties of the system, that the perturbation looks like I'm adding swaps. Okay, I have an AKLT state, an AKLT Hamiltonian, plus some swap terms that's depending on how far am I away from that AKLT point. And so this is not quite right. Of course, you could do perturbation theory on this thing, but it's a bit non-trivial. But loosely, we can think of our ground state near the AKLT state, but not on it, as being like the AKLT state plus some swaps on that state. So this is just meant to give us some intuition on why things are not working. With the identity gate, the only thing that mattered was the total number of Pauli operators of x and y and z. And in particular, the total number of x's and y's and the total number of y's and z's. So you can swap that around and it won't change the total number. So the identity gate's protected against sort of swap errors, if you like to think of it that way. The rotation gate is not, though, because we have this rotation plus a Pauli correction. And so if you swap the order of the gate with a Pauli correction on a neighbor, and that Pauli's of sort of the wrong type that doesn't commute with the gate, then you're going to get a different result. So that's the loose problem here is that the rotation gates are not protected against these swaps. Yeah?
Yeah, I just wonder what happens to the cluster space with the rotation from one point to the other.
Okay, so for the cluster state, so within the simple model we talked about with just a local X field,
uh-huh.
that you can write down correlations for the rotation gate for the cluster state, and those are also long range within the phase. They're just like the identity gate.
Uh-huh.
So in this example, as soon as you add rotations, they drop off fast.
Mm-hmm.
But in the cluster state, the opposite is true, actually. They maintain their long range behavior. Okay, so I'm going to just tell you very quickly a trick that's going to protect us against these swap errors. Is that if we want to do some Z rotation, what we're going to do, we imagine we're going to measure this one in this weird rotated basis. And what we want to do is make sure that the polys on either side of it are ones that commute with that rotation. So we're going to measure those first. And we're going to post-select on getting the Z outcome and the Z outcome. That only occurs with probability 1/9. But if we don't get it, we'll just measure the middle one in that same basis. We get a collection of poly corrections, and then we just move on and try again. If it does work, though, then we can do our gate in the intermediate spot. And it doesn't matter if we have a swap here or a swap here. Everything will act identically. So we tested this numerical. You can do a similar thing with X. So by doing these bufferings, okay, they're going to reduce the success probability of your gate, but then they're hopefully going to increase the fidelity. And our numerics, again, thanks to Joe, showed that with one level of buffering, you definitely get an increase in fidelity. Now, we'd like to say something more specific than just some numerics here. And so I'm going to just very quickly, in the last 1 minute, try to go through a justification of why this buffering is working in terms of renormalization. So just very briefly, what does renormalization mean? Renormalization means that we're going to pick a set of spins, and we're going to treat them, we're going to sort of zoom out and treat them as one spin. So we want to find a map that takes three spins to one, and then we do that on that one, and on that one, and that one. And if we've chosen this mapping from three spins to one correctly, we're going to be zooming out from sort of the short range behavior. We're not going to see that anymore. We're just going to maintain the long range order in the state, and we're going to go to some fixed point which is representative of that whole state. And chosen correctly, we're going to be able to get that representative to be the AKLT state. So how do you do this in a bit more detail? Well, what you do is you take the three spins, you do this decomposition of the energy spectrum of those three spins, and try to pick out just the low energy states, and you throw away the high energy states. And you pick out just enough low energy states that you keep the right dimension. There's a whole bunch of caveats in here that I'm not going to talk about. So that's fine as a process that you can think about doing on a computer, because you can just throw away states and keep the stuff you want. If you're imagining this as a physical process, you imagine my state has some amplitude here, and it has some amplitude up here. If we're in a renormalization process that moves more and more towards the AKLT state with every iteration, we're thinking that our gates are going to work well on here and are going to perform poorly on here. But we can't just throw away the amplitude of the states that's on this poor performing area. We need a physical process that sort of implements this renormalization. And this is essentially what the buffering does, is that if you look at the amplitude of these three qubits post-measurement, post-buffering measurement, we've increased the amplitude down here and decreased it up here. So by doing those buffering measurements and post-selecting on the ones we want, we are creating something that's acting more like the AKLT state. And you might imagine extending these bufferings to more and more and more sites. Okay, sorry to rush through that, because that was almost the most exciting part. But let me just finish with
a few conclusions here. I've already talked about what we've learned from the abstract cluster model. We've learned some more things from looking at this more realistic model. We've learned that, one, this framework still works, that you can look for correlation functions which describe your gates. But in the situation where you don't have, the correlation functions aren't good order parameters, you might think of ways to sort of fix it up and correct it, and using renormalization as an idea for the types of things you might do to say, well, okay, I want to do something that corresponds to a measurement on this qubit that's going to do my gate or my rotation or whatever. I know I'm not exactly at the point in the phase that I want, so what I'm going to have to do is actually pick a region and measure observables on that region to try to distill out something that, if I imagine renormalizing that state, taking that whole region and mapping it to a single point, that this set of observables I measure on this region will act like the observable I want, the measurement I want, on that idealized, renormalized point. Okay, that's a bit vague, sorry, but I'm, I think that's the idea. So just the types of things we would obviously do next is ask about how these things behave at finite temperature. In particular, for this AKLT model, people have studied finite temperature effects, and it's the analytical nature of it makes it quite amenable. You'd look at higher dimensions maybe to protect against finite temperature effects and so on, because that's what also we've learned from the cluster state. Rausendorf's newest schemes use surface codes in a three-dimensional cluster state to protect against thermal errors. And then finally, the type of thing that Steve Flamia and Dave Bacon are working on in terms of gate teleportation seems also very naturally suitable to these models, rather than thinking of it as a measurement-based model. So we'd like to try to apply those things as well. Okay, sorry for going over time. Thanks very much.
So I guess I have a couple of questions. The simplest is just what about two-qubit gates? Is this something?
So for the cluster state, it's quite straightforward. As long as you're in a 2D or higher dimensional cluster state, we can figure out correlation functions that correspond to C sines and C naughts and so on. It's quite often more tricky to see how those correlation functions will behave in a general perturbation or whatever, but that's just a problem of working up details. In this model, the AKLT model, as we know it so far, it's really a one-dimensional model. And Gavin and Akimasa have made it universal by putting down strips of these 1D systems and then essentially coupling them in a standard unitary way. They've made it more measurement-based, but it's a bit of a hybrid there. So really what you would want to do to get genuine measurement-based two-qubit gates is to have a genuine 2D or higher dimensional system which maintains these AKLT-type properties. That's just a big open area for research that I'm very interested in.
Yeah? It's been a long time since I've thought about renormalization. So I'm wondering, can you tell me what the standard view on what's happening when you do renormalization and contrast that with the picture that you've got here?
So the standard view is that you're going to look at some model, and what you're interested in is long-range behavior of things. So you're interested in these types of correlation and functions and things like that, which are sort of generic to the phase. And you're not interested in specific microscopic details that occur amongst a few neighboring spins. And so there's the general idea of what you want to do is just a way to zoom out and stand back and to say, okay, I want to think of this lattice. This is what this picture is doing, is that you think you just stand back far enough that you can't resolve three spins, so you just treat that as an effective new spin. So
I mean, the general idea, people use renormalization now for many different things, but the general idea that sets it all is just a way to identify the long-range behavior while just getting rid of all of the short-range things I'm not interested in. And generally, that's what we would like to do as well. We get the idea that within this phase, I mean, it's a hope, it's a conjecture, but within this phase, we have long-range behavior which is allowing us to do measurement-based quantum computing. If only we could just get rid of all those short-range errors which have to do with the specific local details of the Hamiltonian. And so we would like to find a way to renormalize a measurement-based quantum computation, such as to say, okay, well, you know, I have a whole bunch of systems here. I know that locally, if I measure individual ones, I'm going to get effects that are due to all these local terms that I don't care about. But if I start to measure whole collections of them over a region, I can probably distill out of that some things that don't depend on those details. And that's the idea that we're trying to do here, even though it's not even a very well-formed method yet. But it's the loose idea. We're hoping that there is the types of long-range behavior that would allow us to do quantum computation if only we can get rid of the short-range details. And so renormalization seems like the right thing to start with.
So let me ask one follow-up question. One of the differences that I thought existed, but correct me if I'm wrong, is that the standard view is that renormalization is something you do, it's not a physical process you do in the lab to sample, but it's something you do as you model.
Yeah.
But your buffering procedure was something that you actually have to do
yes.
in the system.
Yeah, I mean, it would be, so one thing we know is that if we take any state in this phase and apply this very specific type of renormalization, a 3-to-1, and you have to be careful with the details, that the fixed point of that will be the AKLT state. And so you keep applying these sort of isometries in going from 3-to-1, where you just, in your computer, you just discard all the high energy states and keep only the low ones. Now, how would you do that in the lab? Well, you can't just, you know, turn down the amplitude of what you don't like. So we have to do some measurements and post-select. And that's, you know, what I was trying to convey here is that we do these buffering measurements. We on next nearest neighbors, we measure. If we get the same result, then it implies actually the posterior amplitude for this is higher and that's lower. If we get different outcomes, then, I mean, it's the other way around. We're more likely to be up here. But then you say, I don't care, I'll just measure the middle one in that standard basis and move on, try again. So returning something that's, yeah, not a physical process into a probabilistic physical process. Modulo, we still have some details to work on.
So Steve, does your, this process of whatever stabilizing the gate, maybe a little better. It still applies to gates on single. So is this correct or not? Does it still? You're still doing gates between single spins, but you're using the renormalization to sort of make that work better by getting rid of some short range behavior that does bad stuff. But the ultimate gate is between a single cycle and single cycle.
Yes.
Because you might have thought, oh, I could use renormalization like I did to do sort of encoded computing. But this is a little different, I guess.
I wish I had an answer to that. I mean, in some sense, I do think this is a bit like doing things in an encoded way. So I'm not sure I have anything.
But the overall gate you do is not on an encoded degree of freedom.
Well, it, in a sense, it is. I mean, going back to what we were discussing in the foundations seminar before about matrix product states is that, you know, one way to think of this state, you know, with different boundary conditions is instead of having this maximum entangled state, you set an initial and a final state for these amplitudes. And then we think of these, you know, you're basically by choosing the measurement basis on some spin, you're just choosing the operation to act on that initial state to get to some final amplitude. And so there is a sense in which you think of the you think of a qubit that's moving along these AKLT states as you measure it. And then you're going to act on it with gates. And so that's where this sort of picture is maybe most suitable. As you think of it going along here, I've done my Z rotation, and then I do my X rotation, and then I might have a C knot or something with the neighbor and so on, and then do more single qubit units. But that's also very different than a picture of looking at the renormalization as a bit of an encoding, because then we'd be encoding on sort of blocks of these things rather than in terms of that correlation space qubit moving along.
But somehow one thinks that ladder way of doing things might be useful, or I mean, maybe fault tolerant that encoding seems a lot like that. And I don't know if you take advantage of the understanding of the normalization parts and maybe design good.
Well, I mean, the one thing we were trying to think of how to think of this error model, if this ansatz is sort of right, and we can loosely think of swap errors as being applied. So a swap error in this perspective means that you've had an error in your ordering of the gates. Like you might have thought I've done this gate, then that gate, but actually you've done them in the opposite order. And I don't know if anyone's ever thought of that type of error model or if it's even amenable to our usual techniques. But that's the type of thing that's going on here. And so if we're choosing to do gates only in a specific order, that it won't matter if we accidentally switch the order. But I mean, at the moment, it's just it's an ad hoc method based on some intuition. And we're trying to make more sense of this in general terms, in terms of renormalization. But it might also be fruitful to try to make sense of this in more general terms as an error-correcting scheme against temporal misordering of things.
Yeah? Your scheme didn't protect against swaps between two triplets, right? Right, it swaps within one triplet, correct?
So the scheme, the buffering width and the renormalization doesn't capture that. So if these were right beside each other, then I'd have this Z and this X, and if they get swapped, it doesn't matter. But when I describe things in terms of this renormalization map, it didn't seem to incorporate that effect that it's also protecting across those boundaries. So the exact understanding of the buffering, which is just an ad hoc method we've used in terms of renormalization, I mean, it's not clear there's going to be just an exact analogy there. There's something a bit different going on, and we don't fully understand exactly the relationship. So we expect as you make these, I could add more Zs and more Zs. Probability goes down, but fidelity should go up. And I should be able to make it arbitrarily high. There's no limitation there in sort of what you can protect against all powers of swap errors up to some fixed power with the right buffer.
Other questions? Thanks, Stephen, again.